Happy New Year to one and all, wherever in the world you may be. Welcome to this January 2009 Science News Update. This is your host, Jim Campanella, who's hoping for a great new year to unfold before us. Anything will be better than failing loan companies and strangulating gas prices from last year. This month, instead of concentrating on one big topic, I have three fascinating stories that piqued my interest in the last month or so. I hope that you'll find these stories as strange and interesting as I do. And by the way, I have made a New Year's resolution to cut down on my pontificating from this pulpit that Tony has so kindly supplied me. I'll try not to get carried away. Sometimes it is so darn difficult to keep in control when the blood is rising, though. I try not to put my large foot in my mouth, but do not often succeed. We'll see if I can even keep my resolution until the end of this podcast. First up is a disconcerting story that was reported at the November meeting of the North American Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry. Dr. Megan McGee of St. Cloud University reports that antidepressants like fluoxetine, that is the brand name Prozac to most people, make fish depressed in laboratory tests. Embryos of minnows grown in trace amounts of the drug did not react as quickly to danger stimuli, and at higher levels of exposure, the fish stopped eating and apparently stopped looking for mates. Worse yet, it appears that Prozac can have an estrogen-like effect on the fish. That estrogen-like activity can cause physical as well as mental changes in young male fish. It can diminish facial bumps and coloration that females actually use to help them choose mates. Unfortunately, while the prey was made depressed, the voracious predators like striped bass were not slowed down by trace amounts of the drugs. It wasn't until very high levels of the drugs were used on the bass that they began to lose their appetite and their aggression as well. That's pretty bad for the minnows because it means that under the conditions described, they become very easy prey and likely to die out very quickly due to overpredation. So why are scientists so concerned? Big deal, you say? What difference does it make if Prozac makes fish sad with no sex drive? What idiot is going to go around feeding fish antidepressants anyway? It doesn't seem to make much difference except as an intellectual exercise. Well, it does make a difference. If you guys remember, there was a story several months back that was presented by the Starship Sofa called Pump 6 by Paolo Bacigalupi. And that story postulated a world that could almost no longer function because the groundwater was so incredibly contaminated and polluted. Sadly, we are heading in that direction. Dr. Melissa Schultz of the College of Worcester, who's a specialist in water treatment and toxicology, reports that, quote, pretty much any water sample in the vicinity of a wastewater treatment plant will test positive for a whole group of antidepressants, unquote. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we have gotten to the point in history where our population is so heavily medicated that water treatment plants can hardly keep up, and we are peeing potential poisons into the streams, lakes, and rivers of the world. And that's why this story about the fish is so worrisome. Although Dr. McGee did her fish experiments in the lab, there's a real worry that out in the wild, the same results may be occurring. And it's not just these antidepressants that are found in wastewater. There's a whole cocktail of chemicals. It's still unclear whether ecologists and toxicologists need to be proactive about solving this problem or just waiting to see if it's actually a problem at all. Tony may actually have some insight on this since water is his bailiwick, but this is one of those ongoing stories where we'll just have to wait and see. Speaking of waiting and seeing, that brings us to story number two. If you were a little freaked about that fish story, prepare to be even more freaked by the next story. Whenever I lecture on cancer in my classes, I talk about the causes of cancer. I mean, the essential cause of cancer is a change in your DNA, which induces cells to grow uncontrollably. And that's pretty much the definition of cancer, cells no longer being under control. You may directly inherit those changes in the case of some cancers, like retinoblastoma. Oh, by the way, if you want to read an excellent story about retinoblastoma that captures the disease really, really well, you can read the story From the Corner of His Eye by Dean Kuntz. Anyway, in most cases, in a complex interaction between the environment around you and your inherited genetics, you may become prone to cancer. The environmental factors are many. For example, chemicals, carcinogens like those found in cigarettes. Yes, cigarette smoking is still the leading cause of cancer. I was actually kind of surprised as to what the second leading cause of cancer was. Believe it or not, it's obesity. Who would have guessed? Besides chemicals, carcinogens in the environment, there's also hard radiation. Gamma rays, X-rays, nuclear radiation, and most people are not exposed to hard radiation. However, the third possible environmental factor, soft radiation, ultraviolet radiation, is really quite common. Ironically, DNA primarily absorbs light in exactly the same wavelength as UV radiation from the sun. And yes, ultraviolet does cause all sorts of damage to DNA because of that. And that's why heavy exposure to the sun does cause such a big statistical spike in skin cancer. The fourth environmental cause of cancer are viruses. And it was only about 20 years ago that viruses were still thought to only be a cause of cancer in animals and not in humans. But that's since been shown to be untrue. There are many human viruses that cause cancer. The most well-known among them is the papillomavirus, which can be caught as an STD and cause genital warts. But besides the genital warts, it can cause cervical cancer as well. There is now an anti-papilloma vaccine available for young women. And now we get to that part of my lecture where I always bridle because we're entering into quote-unquote fringe territory. This is the area where science becomes urban legend to the man on the streets. And here's the question. Does electromagnetic radiation cause cancer? In the past, whenever anyone spoke of high levels of EM, they talked about people who lived under high-tension electric lines. Most people on the street will insist that if you live under a high-tension electric line, you will get a tumor. Well, numerous studies in the last 30 years or more have shown that this is false. If you live under those wires, rest assured that statistically, you have no greater a chance than anyone else in the general population of getting cancer. When I tell my students this, inevitably I see a hand shoot up, usually thrusting a cell phone into the air at me. But what about cell phones? I hear they cause brain tumors. In the past, I have quickly put the kibosh to this rumor as being silly, an urban legend, and having no substantiation whatsoever. Unfortunately, I may have to change my tune now. One of the chief makers of Bluetooth gear in the world, the company Interphone, has started this year to correlate research data conducted in 13 countries and 6,400 tumor patients. Although Interphone certainly has a stake in the results, preliminary findings clearly suggest that individuals who use cell phones regularly are 50% more likely than non-users to develop brain tumors. Now, I was scared witless when I read that, and I lost the rest of my wits when I heard how Interphone researchers defined quote-unquote regular cell phone use. Their definition of regular cell phone use is once a week. I thought I was a really light user at maybe one short call a day of a couple of minutes, but once a week? This suggests that if a once a week user is in danger, and I consider myself still a light user at one call per day, then it is likely the risk is even greater for people who use the phone more frequently. Now, these are still preliminary results, but the results of an earlier and much smaller study that Interphone did jointly with the UK, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Finland suggested an increase in tumor risk for people who have used cell phones for more than 10 years. There was an increase of 40% for those long-term users versus no discernible risk for people who have not used a cell phone for 10 years at all. Again, very scary. And the scariest thing is that the researchers have no idea whatsoever how the tumors are being induced. There's simply not enough energy in the EM bandwidth produced by a cell phone to do any damage to DNA. There are some vague, foggy theories that suggest that EM is not doing direct damage, but maybe messing up growth control pathways of cells, but there's no evidence of that yet. And frankly, it is as good a guess as microscopic evil gnomes doing the DNA damage at this point. As I said, it certainly is to the advantage of the Interphone company to do this research, because it will increase the sales of their Bluetooth headphones if it turns out to be true. At the same time, if independent research lab groups come to the same conclusions, it is certainly going to change the way we use cell phones in a myriad of ways. By the way, let me make another point about cancer. And this is something that people just don't seem to quite understand. Cancer is not a single disease. I know this is getting off the topic a little bit, but I think it's important for people to understand this. Cancer is not a single disease. Cancer is a dozen or two dozen or five dozen different diseases. There's a huge difference between a myeloma and a sarcoma and every other type of cancer. They're caused by innumerable different changes in the DNA to a whole myriad of different genes. Why am I even making this point? Well, a lot of people seem to think that it's going to be really easy for science to come up with a magic bullet, a single way of curing all cancer. That's like saying that we're going to come up with a single way of curing all disease. It simply isn't going to happen. There's no easy way of curing cancer in and of itself, because cancer is not a single disease. If it was, we'd have more of a chance of doing that. I heard a conversation between two men while I was in a doctor's waiting room once, several years back, and I just thought it was bizarre. Basically, they were waiting for their colonoscopies, and one man turned to the other and said, "You know, I really hate to do this every year. It just really sucks. And, you know, I think that they've already got the cure for cancer, so and those drug companies aren't telling us about it, and they're making millions of dollars, and you know what? It really isn't fair." And the other fellow turned to him and went, "Yeah, I agree. You're absolutely right. They got the cure for cancer out there, and it's just not right." And all I could think of at the time when I heard this conversation is, you guys are idiots. If a drug company actually did have the cure for cancer, don't you think that they would actually have it out there on the market, making billions off of it? Could you imagine the one thing that a drug company would think of as a golden cash cow but that? Unfortunately, there is no magic bullet. There are no drug companies that are secretly hiding these cures. It's unfortunate, but that is the case. And because, as I've said, cancer is this kind of strange disease which is so very different from many others, it may be a long time before anything like that happens. I think that perhaps nanotechnology is maybe our best bet in the cure of cancer, and not drugs and not many of the other methods. That being able to program a nanorobot, if you can imagine that, or a microrobot, to be able to find the cancer and destroy the cancer and get rid of the cancer in a very specific manner as opposed to other cells, that might be the way to go. And unfortunately, even in that case, you'd have to have 100 differently type of programmed robots for all the different kinds of cancer. The last news item is freaky, but still seriously cool. Now, I'm a fan of the late SF writer Jack Chalker. He had some great original ideas, and few writers have been able to match him in sheer bravura space opera adventure. And lots of people forget that a good deal of the movie The Matrix was borrowed, quote-unquote, from his Wonderland Gambit books, including the whole Alice in Wonderland theme. But Chalker is most remembered for his obsession with changing the bodies of his characters in radical and weird ways, usually by some sort of body swapping. Men were swapped with other men, women with women, women with men, human into alien bodies. Chalker's most famous book on the matter, The Identity Matrix, dealt almost entirely with that theme. But you could find the idea in a great many of his books. In fact, he, along with Mike Resnick and George Alec Effinger, even made fun of his well-known foible in a round-robin novel called The Red Tape War, which is still in print, I believe. Where am I going with this? Well, we still do not have the technology to swap bodies, but there have recently been some neuroscience experiments that suggest that our brains have the ability to swap bodies in a virtual manner. Valeria Petkova and Henrik Ehrson of the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm have been doing some very interesting work in this area. Volunteers in the body swap experiment stand across from a mannequin or a female volunteer. A headset covers the participant's eyes and feeds him a 3D view of the other body's visual perspective, which is being transmitted from the other body's camera. The two then receive simultaneous visual and motor input. To induce the illusion of body swapping, an experimenter touches the bellies of both the participants at the same time and in the same way, with a feather, for example. The volunteer feels the tickling on their own bellies as they see their counterpart being treated in the same way. This can also be done by shaking hands, for example. The participant feels the shaking hand, but sees themselves from the perspective of the other person. After 10 or 15 seconds of this, the brains of the participants begin to realign themselves to see themselves in the body of the mannequin or the female. Apparently, the illusion is quite complete until it's broken by their own movement. Participants said that the illusion was so good that they believed absolutely that their counterpart would move with them if they moved. Participants jumped backwards, in fact, when a knife was thrust at their counterparts. Participants in the experiment displayed elevated electrical activity on their skin when their counterpart was touched. As my wife said when I told her about this, that is just plain freaky. The results of this experiment suggest that with multi-sensory input into the brain, you can fool it into believing all sorts of things about your body. It's been suggested that these experiments might be useful for better understanding people who have severe self-identity dysphoria or body image problems. The better suggestion is that it may help game designers to enhance virtual reality experiences in games and really bring them to life. I think that the late Jack would be proud that someone is actually looking into this body swap stuff, even if it is just an illusion. Well, I warned you that my science stories were a motley collection this month, but I hope that you found them enlightening. Thanks for listening. As always, take care, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.